Good morning. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Focus on Campus. And joining us today is Michael Vinson. Mike received his master's in the history of the book from the University of Chicago in 1987. He began working that year as a curator in the Western Americana collection of Southern Methodist University, SMU, in Dallas. And while there, he wrote an exhibition catalog, Motoring Tourists and the Scenic West, which was selected for first place as the best exhibition catalog from the Association of College and Research Libraries, and was also selected as one of the best 50 Western books of 1989 by the Rounce and Coffin Club. He has published articles on Western Americana in the A.B. Bookman Weekly, such as Western Americana at Auction, in the October 5, 1992 issue, and presented a paper at the Western History Association meeting in 1992. New Ranges for Collecting Western American History, Is It Time to Put the Old Bibliographies Out to Pasture?, which was published in 1994 issue of RBNM, a journal of rare books. And we are going to have the pleasure of listening to Mike next week here on campus. Mike, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us here today.
Thanks, Louie. I'm glad to do it.
Mike will be visiting us here, as I mentioned, Tuesday. That's October 9th at 5:30 p.m. His presentation will be at the Blumberg Auditorium, room 111. And the name of his talk, interesting, is Bookworms in the Old West, Fur Traders, Cowboys, and Other Frontier Readers. Interesting topic there.
Yes, it is. When we think of the Old West, we often think of the exciting events, Billy the Kid, gunfighters, marshals and sheriffs. Pat Garrett has an El Paso connection. But we don't often think of what they did in their spare time. In the evenings when there was no radio or television or anything else to do. And what I was able to find out in my research is that, of course, they took books with them and things to read, and I was able to find a number of interesting stories about that.
One of the things that we hear a lot when we're listening to whether a radio show, a TV show, is you hear about, you know, the dime novels. You hear about Harper's Weekly. And, of course, that was the big one during the 1860s and 70s. And shortly after President Lincoln was shot, that was apparently, one of the newspapers that was read by people in the West who were able to get a copy of it from things like that. However, as you mentioned, what did they do in their spare time? And it brings to mind one of the old radio dramas, Gunsmoke, where Chester is reading Shakespeare. And he's telling Marshall Dillon, I think this guy is one of them foreigners because his English ain't too good, Mr. Dillon.
That's a great story. I don't recall that episode, but I liked it a lot. Shakespeare actually was the best-selling author in America in the 19th century. People read him widely along with Charles Dickens. And so, you know, we think of the dime novels, we think of the bawdry tales, the things that are more exciting, but Shakespeare actually was one, and it was fairly widespread, surprisingly enough. Frederick W. Lander was a surveyor who came out west in the 1850s and 60s and helped survey a lot of the west in the and made the maps that we know today. But Lander had an assistant who wrote about traveling with Lander, and one of the experiences they had, they got snowbound up in the Sierra Nevadas. And while they were up there in the Sierra Nevadas, they went down and they were able to find a little bit of meadowland that wasn't covered in snow yet for their horses and mules. And they found a hermit down there who was living in sort of a rough log cabin, and he came out dressed in flour sacks. And just like out of True Grit, he had a wolf's head on his head that he wore for a hat with the ears peaked straight up, the fellow said. And he thought, where did this guy come from? The assistant to Lander did. And it turns out that the fellow, they asked him how he spent his time in the winter, because he said he stayed up there all winter long. And he said, I spend my time reading Dickens. The fellow didn't believe him a bit. And he went out to his flour barrel and he pulled out two copies. He had Pickwick and he had Nicholas Nickleby. And the assistant was surprised to note that he knew them by heart and had obviously read them many times.
Interesting, and perhaps you can help us verify the story, and I'm not sure why somebody would make this up, but apparently General Grant, he was asked several times to write his memoirs, and he kind of put it off, until finally when he fell into financial straits, dire straits, and the fact that he was also sick, he decided to do it, but because Mark Twain was the first guy to approach him, he decided to sign a deal with Mark Twain.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, absolutely. Twain did do that. But Twain was much more of an entrepreneur than we realized. We often think of Twain as the famous author, of course, of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn and many other books. But he was also an entrepreneur. He lived in Hartford, Connecticut. He was close friends with General Grant. And he was the one who had encouraged Grant to write his memoirs with the intent of publishing them all along. Grant died shortly after the memoirs were finished, but before they were published, but it was a great boon for his widow. And Twain was involved in the publication of those. Unfortunately, not every venture that Twain got into worked out well for them, so he'd earned these fortunes on his books and then plowed them into other ventures that didn't always work out so well for him.
You hear, whether it be through movies, books you read, that the Bible was perhaps one of the easiest books, I guess, to get a hold of, and that's why if you find an old Bible, it may not be worth that much.
That's absolutely right. The Bible was the best-selling book. I mentioned Shakespeare and Dickens, but far more than that was the Bible, just copies of the Bible. Every home wanted to have one. Oftentimes, people would keep their personal family history. You might find an old Bible that has a genealogy in it of sorts, birth dates, marriage dates, or death dates of family members that were recorded in the front of the Bible. But as far as a bestseller goes, as far as an old book goes, I mean, the Bible is probably the most common one. To have a Bible that would be really valuable, there would have to be something unique about it. If it were carried by or owned by a famous person, for example, then it would be called an association copy, and those would have more value than just the regular book. But oftentimes when people bring a book like that to me to have appraised, of course I don't charge them anything. I just look at them and I tell them to don't quit playing the lottery, and probably the book has more sentimental value than economic value.
And what about as far as school books go? Because children did not always have the opportunity to go to school, and you know, some towns had small schools, and because, I guess, space and lack of teachers, they put everybody in the same room. But they used those readers, and sometimes you'll see some of those readers at garage sales. Are those things valuable?
They can be. The McGuffey's readers are the ones that are most common and most well-known. You know, oftentimes there are a lot of reprints of the McGuffey readers that were done as well. And so the things that tend to make a book valuable or collectible, first of all, it has to be a book that other people want to purchase. So it's not just the fact that it's old or that it's well-known, but it's also a book that's collected is probably the most important fact. And then after that, then it becomes the condition. It becomes a number of other factors after that that affect the value of the book. But first and foremost, it has to be a book that other people want to purchase.
As far as your talk on Tuesday, Bookworms in the Old West, Fur Traders, Cowboys, and Other Frontier Readers, can you kind of guide us through what you're going to talk about? Are you going to show pictures of perhaps old books? Talk about the past times, as you mentioned. You know, what did Wyatt Earp do when he was not out shooting a gun, or what was Doc Holliday or the Rustlers, etc.? Because as you mentioned earlier, we kind of fantasize and have these fantasies about the Old West that all they did was go out and, you know, look for gunfighters, posses, and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider. Most of your listeners will probably be familiar with Kit Carson.
Yes.
Lived in New Mexico, famous frontiersman in the Southwest, fur trapper and colonel in the Army, fought the Navajo Indians. Kit Carson, of course, was famous within his own lifetime, even though he himself was illiterate. He couldn't read himself. That was probably more the exception than the rule, actually, because of the democracy of education in America. But anyway, at one point, somebody back east writes a biography of him, and at his home, I assume, in Taos or New Mexico, somebody reads the book aloud to him in evening time. And at the end, after reading the entire book through to him, they asked him what he thought of it. And he looked at him and he said, "Well, that there may be true, but I think he laid it on a little thick." And on another occasion, somebody showed him one of these dime novel magazines that showed Kit Carson on the cover. And we have his experience of seeing this. Somebody recorded it, what he thought about it when he saw it. So they show him this cover of him standing over a rescued white woman, which was based on an actual experience that he had up in the panhandle of Texas. And there are six Indians laying around on the ground, all dead, and he's lifting the white woman up on the cover of this dime novel. And, yeah, you know, someone said, "Kit, do you remember that incident?" And he said, "Well, thought that may be true, but I have no recollection of it." So at least he was honest.
As far as books go, There are a couple of books that recently, well, one of them, of course, is True Grit, which they made a remake of the John Wayne character. And the other one is The Shootist, which was John Wayne's last movie. And both books, for a while there, were very hard to find. And if you did find a copy of them, and I believe The Shootist especially, by Glendon Swarthout, was very hard to find, and it was very expensive if you did find it. Is that because of...
That's a collectible book, and I think part of that, you know, with True Grit, I actually, after the movie came out, I had remembered the John Wayne version. I'd seen that when I was a boy, and so I was curious to see the remake, and I loved the remake. I thought that it was... And actually, when you read the book, it's much truer to the book than the original John Wayne was. So that to me was fun to read, and it's interesting to consider these sort of that novel was written in the 1960s. So what you're looking at is sort of the attempt in the 1960s to relook at these experiences in the West and think about them in a different way than perhaps people did in the 1950s, when it was much more about the glorification of Davy Crockett or Daniel Boone or whoever it was. And instead you have sort of the anti-hero experience of the girl in True Grit, as well as... if you would think, I don't believe that this was a novel, but it was a movie with Jane Fonda, Cat Ballou, also becomes sort of an anti-hero movie.
The Shootist originally took place in El Paso. And from what I understand is that they were going to film in El Paso, but by 1976, El Paso was a little bit too modern, and John Wayne was sick, and so they had to go a different way. But that book was out of print for a while, and... I was just looking up some information before we decided to, before we called you, and now it's available, but it's available in Kindle only.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't realized that. That's a book that I haven't read, and I'll have to go look that one up. I love the El Paso connection. There's a number of outlaws and lawmen as well that have had a connection with El Paso.
It mentions John Wesley Hardin.
Yes, absolutely. John Wesley Hardin's probably the most famous. I actually had a descendant through one of Hardin's relations. Hardin was pretty cold-blooded when it came to robbing trains and doing the things that he did before he got shot in the saloon in El Paso. He, at one point, and it was a descendant that told me this story, he met his cousin on the train that he was robbing, and he was robbing all the passengers on the train. And his cousin thought that he'd let him go, and he goes, "Cuz, you got grandfather's gold watch, now it's mine."
That's a great story.
That is. Of course, it's one of those undocumented ones. It was a descendant that told me that story, but you have to like something like that. I just, I thought it was great. There was another lawman as well that was a book collector.
Uh-huh.
James B. Gillette has an El Paso connection as well. He wrote a book called 6 Years with the Texas Rangers that came out in 1921. And he lived in Marfa. He ended up in Marfa. And Gillette was famous sort of because of his book and his experiences in the 1870s of writing with the Texas Rangers. But I actually had the opportunity to purchase some of the books from his library. And Gillette was a book collector. He loved books, and he loved reading about Napoleon, he loved reading about Custer, and he loved reading about the Old West. And in some of his books, he actually annotated in pencil what he thought of the book. So that was a lot of fun, too.
One of the accolades that I talked about before I introduced you was the fact that your book was selected as one of the 50 best Western books of 1989 by the Rounce and Coffin Club. And people may be sitting back listening and go, "Rounce and Coffin Club? I'm not sure I would be one become recognized by the Coffin Club."
Exactly, exactly. I loved it, though, because the Rounce and Coffin Club, unfortunately, I don't know where their name derives from, but it's the name of a book of group collectors who appreciate fine press and well-done Western books. And each year they will select 50 of the best ones, and they'll go on a traveling exhibition in different libraries around the country. We'll host these sort of a selection of these 50 best books that the Rounce and Coffin Club has selected, and they've been doing this for a long time now.
When you speak next week, Mike, are you going to have anything available that people might be interested in perhaps purchasing or subscribing to or anything like that?
No, I will have. I did bring along some of my catalogs, rare book catalogs that I'm going to pass out for free. So I'll have something free for people, but nothing to purchase.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, I will be doing our public radio fund drive here. So I'm going to try and sneak away and go listen to you because I love Western and the Old West and Western books in general. But we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Hey, Louis. thank you for your time, and for all of you listeners, be sure and support your local radio station there. It's very important to them, and it helps bring great shows like this that you get to listen to.
Thank you very much, Mike, for that nice plug. We've been visiting with Mike Vinson. The topic of his talk is Bookworms in the Old West, Fur Traders, Cowboys, and Other Frontier Readers, and that will be at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 9th, at the University Library, Blumberg Auditorium, Room 1-1. Again, Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Lily.
Focus on Campus is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Focus on Campus. I'm Louis Sines.